This is tape 17 of John Howie's Biographia Scoticana, or The Scots Worthies, the 1781 edition, narrated by Larry Berger with assistance from Lynn Hopewell. This work is available from Stillwater's Revival Books, along with a treasure trove of the finest Protestant, Reformed, and Puritan literature available anywhere in the world today. Stillwater's may be reached at 780-450-3730 or by email at swrb@swrb.com. Stillwater's website is www.swrb.com and contains numerous free books and articles. Please note that these tapes are not copyrighted, and we therefore encourage you to copy and distribute them to any and all you believe would be benefited. We continue our reading of the life of Mr. Thomas Hogg. Mr. Hogg, being thus settled, he heartily applied himself to his work, taking heed to himself and his doctrine, that he might both save himself and them that heard him, casting a good copy or example before them in all manner of temperance and Christian virtues, but more especially remarkable in his public character. His concern and sympathy with the ignorant was great. The bulk of the people of that parish, through the long infirmity of their former pastor and the intervening vacation, being neglected in their examination, became very ignorant, but he was at great pains in spreading catechisms and other abstracts among them, and going from house to house, he prayed with, exhorted, and instructed them in the things pertaining to the kingdom of God. And his deportment was attended with as much majesty proper to that function as had been observed in any. And no wonder, for few were favored with so many testimonies of the divine presence in the discharge of their ministry, as witness J.N., E.B., his spouse, B.B., her sister, afterwards Mrs. S., Mrs. R., the judicious and famous John Monroe of Ross, Mr. Thomas Taylor, Mr. Angus McBean, minister at Inverness, John Bullock, his own servant, Christian McIntosh, a poor woman in the depths of soul distress, Mr. Holy Mr. Ross, Mr. John Wellwood, and the so much famed John Monroe were either converted or confirmed by him while in this parish, or after his ejection while he was settled at Knockgoddy in Murray. And none more particular than that instance of Monroe of Lumlair, an heritor in that parish, who, upon some reprehensory expressions by Mr. Hogg, which he was at first dreadfully offended at, yet were made the means of his thorough conversion, so that he ever looked on Mr. Hogg as his best friend, and laid himself out to promote the success of his ministry. So soon as it pleased the Lord thus to bless his parochial labors with a gracious change wrought upon a considerable number of the people, he took care to join the more judicious in societies for prayer and conference. These he kept under his own inspection, and did heartily concur with them, for he himself was much in the exercise of that duty, and had several notable returns thereof, of which we have several instances. First, a good woman having come to help him with this sore lamentation that her daughter, C.L., was distracted, Mr. Hogg charged one or two devout persons, for he frequently employed such on extraordinary occasions, to set apart a day and a night for fasting and prayer, and then join with him in prayer for the maid next day. Accordingly, when this appointment was performed, she recovered her senses as well as before. Secondly, a daughter of the Laird of Parks, his brother-in-law, who lodged with him, being seized with a high fever and little hope of life, Mr. Hogg loved the child dearly, and while he and his wife were jointly supplicating the Lord in prayer, acknowledging their own and the child's iniquity, the fever instantly left her. This passage was found in his own diary, which he concludes with admiration upon the goodness of God, to whom he ascribes the praise of all. Third, in like manner, a child of the Reverend Mr. Urquhart, having been at the point of death, those present pressed Mr. Hogg to pray, for he was now become so esteemed that none other would in such case do it, he being present, upon which he solemnly charged them to join with him, and having fervently wrestled in prayer and supplication for some time, the child was restored to health. A like instance is found of a child of Kinmundy's in his own diary. Fourthly, one David Dunbar, who lived at a distance, being in a frenzy, came to Mr. Hogg's house in one of his fits. Mr. Hogg caused him to sit down, and having advised with Mr. Fraser of Bray, and some others present, what could be done for the lad, some were for letting blood, but Mr. Hogg said, "The prelates have deprived us of money wherewith to pay physicians, therefore let us employ him who cures freely," and so laid it on Mr. Fraser to pray, but he put it back on himself. So after commanding the distracted person to be still, he prayed fervently for the poor man, and he was immediately restored to his right mind. This is faithfully attested by those who were eye and ear witnesses. Fifthly, Mr. Hogg, having once gone to see a gracious woman in great extremity of distress, both of body and mind, he prayed with and for her, using this remarkable expression among many others, O Lord, rebuke this temptation, and we in thy name rebuke the same. And immediately the woman was restored, both in body and mind. And yet, notwithstanding the Lord had honored him in such a manner, it is doubtful if any in his day more carefully guarded against delusions than he did, it being his ordinary, whenever he bowed a knee, to request to be saved from delusions, and so on. But as Mr. Hogg was sent of God to be an ambassador of peace to some, so he was also a messenger of wrath to others, of which we have several instances, but none more particular than the following, of a certain gentleman in the parish, who had one dead in his family, and intended to bury in the kirk, but on account of the vulgar superstition the General Assembly had by an act discharged the same, and Mr. Hogg, being a strenuous defender of the act of the church, the gentleman was nonplussed what to do. But one William Monroe, a strong hectoring fellow, engaged to make his way good against all opposition, and succeeded so far that the people with the corpse were entering the churchyard when Mr. Hogg got notice. He went out and set his back to the door, through which the corpse was to pass, and began to reason with the people to convince them of their error in breaking through good order. But this had not the desired effect, for the fellow laid violent hands on Mr. Hogg to pull him from the door. But he, having the spirit of a man as well as of a Christian, turned on his adversary, wrestled the key out of his hand, and told the assailant, were he to repel force with force, probably he would be no gainer. And then said to the people, this man hath grieved the spirit of the Lord, and you shall see either his sudden repentance or a singular judgment befall him. Accordingly, the poor wretch continued in his wicked courses and met with the foretold judgment in a few months after that. Having made a violent attack upon one who drew out the wretch's sword and dagger, and thrust him through the belly, so that his bowels burst out, and he died most miserably. Another instance of this kind fell out while he was lecturing in the Laird of Lethem's house in the county of Murray. During the time of worship, he observed a servant laugh once and again, and after an admonition, the third time, at which Mr. Hogg paused a little, and then with an air of severity said, the Spirit of God is grieved by one in the company for mocking at these great truths. Therefore I am bold to say, such offers of grace shall be visibly and more suddenly punished than any here could wish, and so on. After they had supped and retired to their apartments, a message came to his chamber telling him that the forementioned mocker was seized with a sudden sickness and cried bitterly for him. Upon this Mr. Hogg arose, quickly cast on his gown, and came downstairs to see him without losing a minute's time. But ere he got to him, the poor creature was dead. Mr. Hogg was in judgment on that side called protesters, and therefore was in the beginning of the year 1661 deposed by the Synod of Ross, because he would not decline that party judicially. And afterward, when he knew he was to be put out of the charge at Killearn in the year 1662, he had a farewell sermon to them, where, with the Apostle Paul, he took God and their own consciences to witness that he had not shunned to declare the whole counsel of God to them, and added that the storm would be of a long continuance, but, after all, the sky would clear, and he would live to see it, and be called to his own charge again as minister of Killearn, and die with them. And further said, if any of you shall decline from that good way, and these truths wherein ye have been taught, and shall comply with the wicked designs now carried on, I take heaven and earth to witness against you. I take the stones of these walls I preached in, every word that was spoken, and every one of you to be witnesses against another. With many other words he exhorted them, and his labors were not altogether in vain, for there was not a parish in Scotland that complied less with the corruptions than they did. After his ejection, John Card, who was converted by his ministry, told him that he should go to Murray, of which he had no thoughts then, but in a little the Laird of Park offered him Knockgoddy near Oldearn to labor and dwell in, of which he accepted and went thither, where he was a very useful instrument in the hand of the Lord in turning many souls to him, as has already been said, and in here finding his private ministry so blessed with success, he adventured to give the sacrament in this place, which was a bold attempt, considering the severity of the laws at that time. But this solemnity being remarkably blessed with the divine presence and glory, the communicants returned to their habitations with unspeakable joy, and amongst the rest one MacLeod, who came from Rossshire and understood nothing of the English language. But Mr. Hogg, understanding the Irish language, he told him that he came hither obeying the command of his exalted Redeemer, and understood what was preached here in the English as well as if every word had been spoken in his own tongue. Which, when Mr. Hogg interpreted to the rest, they were filled with wonder, and the good man was allowed to communicate, which he did with joy. The year 1668, he was imprisoned for the truth at Fors, upon a complaint for keeping conventicles and so forth, and there he was wonderfully strengthened and comforted, having great joy in his sufferings. Upon his account many prayers were put up by many in Murray, and their prayers, as one saith of the church's prayers for Peter while in the like case, set God a-working. The effect was that Mr. Hogg, without his own knowledge or expectation, was set at liberty without any concessions on his part. But what was more remarkable, he was again apprehended about the beginning of the year 1676 for the same cause and sent to Edinburgh. He said to some in company, "I thank my God this messenger was most welcome to me," and giving a scratch with his nails on the wall, he said, "I trust in the living God that before my conscience shall get that much of a scratch, this neck," pointing to it, "shall go for it." Accordingly, when tried, he submitted himself joyfully to a prison, rather than bind himself from preaching, and was sent to the Bass, where by the air of the place and his close confinement he fell into a bloody flux, whereof he was in a great danger. A physician being called gave his opinion, unless he was liberated from that place there was no hope of life, but Mr. Hogg, hesitating, would not address that mongrel court at any rate. However, the doctor, of his own accord, did it without his knowledge, and gave in a petition to the council in the strongest terms he could devise. The petition being read, some of the lords interceded for Mr. Hogg and said that he lived more quietly and travelled not the country so much as other Presbyterians did. Upon which Bishop Sharp, taking up the argument, said that the prisoner did, and was in a capacity to do, more hurt to their interests sitting in his elbow chair than 20 others could do by travelling from this corner of the land to the other, and if the justice of God was pursuing him to take him off the stage, the clemency of the government should not interpose to hinder it, and it was his opinion that if there was any place in the prison worse than another, he should be put there. Which motion, being seconded by the prelates, was put to vote and carried to the closest prison in the Bass, which was speedily put in execution. When the keeper intimated this to Mr. Hogg, he said, "It was as severe as if Satan himself had penned it." His servant William Bullock, being with him when he carried him down to that low, nasty dungeon in the Bass, fell a-weeping and cried, "Now, master, your death is unavoidable." But the good man, directing his eyes up, said, "Now, that men have no mercy, the Lord will show himself merciful. From the moment of my entering this dungeon, I date my recovery." And so it fell out, for the very next day he recovered surprisingly, and in a short time was as well as ever. Yet afterward, when speaking of the arch-prelate, he never showed any resentment, but merrily said, "Commend him to me for a good physician." In the end of the year 1679, being brought to Edinburgh before the council, and refusing to take the bond to live peaceably, he was remanded back to prison, and afterwards liberated, but on what conditions we do not learn. About the year 1683, he fell again under the displeasure of the managers for holding private conventicles, and was banished by the Privy Council and ordained to remove off the kingdom in 48 hours unless he gave caution not to exercise any part of his ministry under a penalty of 5,000 merks over and above performance, which conditions he would by no means submit to, and therefore retired to Berwick and from thence to London with a design the first opportunity to go from thence to Carolina. But the pretended plot, called the Presbyterian plot, then falling out, he was thrown into prison, where he continued some time, till his money being near spent, for beside his own and his servant's maintenance, he paid 10 shillings sterling weekly to the keeper for a place by himself, and not to be put down among thieves and felons, he said to his servant William, "I'll set tomorrow apart for prayer and see that no person be allowed to come in to interrupt me." Accordingly, he rose early and continued close at meditation and prayer till 12 o'clock, when a person in the habit of a gentleman desired to speak with him. William Bullock told him that his master was retired and so forth, and yet he still interceded to see him. Upon which William, seeing him of a grave, pleasant aspect, reported his desire to his master, who ordered him to his room. Mr. Hogg received him courteously. The other entertained him with a discourse about suffering for a good God and a good cause, and showed that our light afflictions, which are but for a moment, are not to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed. After which he arose and embraced Mr. Hogg most lovingly, exhorted him to continue in well-doing, and then took out of his pocket a white paper and gave it to him. Mr. Hogg, finding its weight, understood it was money, and said to the stranger, "Upon what account, sir, do you give me this money?" The other answered, "Because I am appointed by our great and exalted master to do so." Mr. Hogg asked his name, and upon his refusing to tell it, Mr. Hogg said, "Sir, it is not curiosity that prompts me to ask, but I hope to be enlarged, and then I shall account it my duty to call for you at your dwelling in this city, for I suppose you are a citizen in London." The other replied, "You must ask me no more questions, but be faithful to the death, and thou shalt have a crown of life." Then he retired, and Mr. Hogg never saw nor heard of him any more. When Mr. Hogg opened the paper, there were £5 sterling in it, which to the good man was sweeter than if he had got £1,000 settled on him yearly. And Howie in a footnote says, "This relation was attested by William Bullock, who was his faithful servant nearly 30 years, who was eye and ear witness, and was inclined to think he was an angel." After he was set at liberty, being at London in the year 1685, when the Duke of Monmouth landed in England, and Argyll in Scotland, he plainly told some of his acquaintance that God would never honor any of these men to be instruments of our deliverance. And much about the same time, some Protestants at court, knowing he was in the city, and that he was endued with the prophetical spirit, drew King James's attention so far that he wanted Mr. Hogg should be consulted concerning affairs at that juncture. This being communicated to him, he concealed his mind till he consulted the Lord by prayer. In the meantime, he made ready for his departure, and then told them, what he charged them to report to him faithfully, that if King James had seriously adhered to the principles of our holy reformed religion, his throne should have been established in righteousness, and if he would yet turn from popery, matters might be well with him, but if otherwise, the land would spew him out. When this was reported, the king ordered that he should be speedily apprehended, but he, having foreseen this, eschewed it by a speedy flight to Holland. When in Holland, he was soon introduced to the Prince of Orange, who had him in great esteem, and therefore led him into the secret of his resolution to deliver these nations from popery and tyranny. In the indulgence, Mr. Hogg agreed with worthy Mr. McWard and Mr. Brown, yet was far from clearness to withdraw from all Presbyterian ministers, who either had not taken the benefit of the indulgence, or those exposed to suffering notwithstanding the same. And Howie says in the footnote, "It must of necessity here be observed that any who are acquainted with the historical accounts of these times will find that Mr. Hogg was not so explicit upon point of public testimony as the more faithful part of our sufferers at that time. Otherwise he was, for parts and attainments, a very remarkable and extraordinary man, as this narrative in part discovers." Returning to the text, Mr. Hogg returned to Scotland the year 1688, where he stayed till 1691, that his old parishioners, finding the way cleared, sent commissioners to accompany him back to his parish of Killearn, where he was received with great joy in June or July that year. But his constitution being broken, he was unable to discharge his function much in public after that. However, his conversation became still more heavenly. King William, as a reward to his merit, resolving to have this good man near him, sent him a commission to be one of his chaplains, which was no mean evidence of his esteem for him and the truth of his prediction concerning him. But before ever that honor was bestowed upon him, he was seized with the trouble, or rather the complication of troubles, whereof he died. His sickness was considerably long and accompanied with great pain. One time his judicious servant, hearing the heavy moans he made, asked whether it was soul or bodily pain that extorted such heavy groans from him, to which he composedly replied, "No soul trouble, man, for 100 and 100 times my Lord hath assured me that I shall be with him forever, but I am making moan for my body," and thereupon entertained him agreeably concerning the Lord's purging away sin from his own children, Isaiah 27, verse 9. At another time he said, "Pity me, O ye my friends, and do not pray for my life. You see I have a complication of diseases upon me. Allow me to go to my eternal rest." And then, with deep concern of soul, he cried, "Look, O my God, upon mine affliction, and forgive all my sins." And yet, says his servant, never was his conversation more heavenly and spiritual than when thus chastised. Toward his end, he was much feasted with our Savior's comfortable message to his disciples, John 20, verse 17, "I ascend to my Father and to your Father, and to my God and your God." To the writer of some remarkable passages of his life, he said, "He could not give a look to the Lord, but he was persuaded of his everlasting love." And to Mr. Stewart, who succeeded him in that place, at another time he said, "Never did the sun in the firmament shine more brightly to the eyes of my body than Christ the Son of Righteousness hath shined on my soul." And some time after, continues the same writer, "when I understood he was very low, I made him my last visit. When I asked him how he did, he answered, 'The unchangeableness of my God is my rock.' Upon Sabbath evening, for I stayed with him that week, when I came from the church, his speech was unintelligible to me, but his servant desired me to pray and commit his soul and body to God. After prayer, I retired a little, and when I returned, I found all present in tears at his dissolution, especially his wife and his faithful servant, William Bullock." Close quote. Mr. James Hogg and the aforementioned writer of the remarkable passages add that Mr. Thomas Hogg had many times foretold that his Lord and husband was coming, so in the end he cried out, "Now he is come, my Lord is come, praises, praises to him forevermore, amen." And with these words death closed his eyes upon the fourth day of January, 1692, being about 60 years old. Mr. Hogg was of a tall stature, but more remarkable for his courage and fortitude of mind. He was most temperate in his diet and sleep. Gluttony, he said, is a great incentive to lust, and rising betimes is not only good for the health, but best adapted for study, wherein he took great pleasure. His more serious work, his necessary diversions, as visiting of friends and so forth, and even meaner things were all gone about by the rule of duty. He was sought unto by many for his good and faithful advices, and in prayer he was most solemn and fervent, the profoundest reverence, the lowest submission, and yet a marvelous boldness and intimacy with God attended his engagements in this exercise. It might truly be said of him as of Luther when he prayed, it was with so much reverence as if he was praying to God, and with so much boldness as if he had been speaking to his friend. And though the Lord did not bless him with natural children, he gave him the powerful assurance of that promise, Isaiah 56:5, "I will give thee a name better than of sons and daughters," which he signally fulfilled to him in making him the instrument of begetting many sons and daughters to the Lord. The life of Mr. Robert Fleming. Mr. Robert Fleming was born at Bathens in the year 1630. He was son to Mr. James Fleming, minister of the gospel there, who, being a very godly and religious man, took great care of his son's education, and for that purpose sent him first to the College of Edinburgh, where he ran through the course of philosophy with great applause and made great progress in the learned languages. Then, being translated to St. Andrews, he passed his course of theology in that university under the conduct of worthy Mr. Rutherford. His natural parts being very great, his understanding quick and penetrative, his judgment clear and profound, his fancy rich, his memory strong, and expressions masculine, they did with such a grace take with them who were not acquainted with his accents or idioms, and to all these his acquired learning was answerable, the culture of which he, through the divine blessing, improved with great diligence. History, the eye of learning, he singularly affected, especially sacred history, the right eye. But to him all history was sacred, seeing he considered God's actions more than man's therein. Nor did he value any man, but for the knowledge of God, wherewith he himself was so much acquainted, for his conversion to God was very early. Before he was full 23 years old, he was called to a pastoral charge, and was settled therein at Cambustang in the Shire of Clydesdale, where he served the Lord in the ministry, till after the restoration of Charles II, when that storm arose that drove out so many, and particularly that act, commonly called the Glasgow Act, whereby near 400 faithful ministers were ejected, of whom the world was not worthy. He had taken to wife Christiana Hamilton, justly famed for her person, gifts, and graces. By her he had 7 children, and with them and himself sweetly committed unto his God's provision, he humbly received the honor of his ejection. Of the children the Lord received three of them to himself before their mother, and two of them died afterward. The other two survived their father for some time. As for his worldly substance, his share seemed according to Agur's desire, and with Luther he said, to his knowledge he never desired much of it, or was very careful for or about it. For during the most tragical days his table was spread and cups filled, and his head anointed with fresh oil. His children were liberally educated, and in his work he was profusely rich, but of his own laying up he had no treasure but in heaven. His own testimony of his life was this: it was once made up of seeming contrarieties, great outward trouble and great inward comfort, and I never found, said he, more comfort than when under most affliction. For some time after his ejection, he lived mostly at Edinburgh, Fife, and other places until September 1673, that all the ministers in and about Edinburgh, being called to appear before the council to hear their sentence, to repair unto the places of their confinement, but he and some others, not appearing, were ordered to be apprehended wherever they could be found, which made him shift as well as he could for some time, till he was at last apprehended and imprisoned in the toll booth of Edinburgh, where he was during the time of Bothwell Battle. A little after, he was, with some others, called before the council, and though they were willing to find bail for their appearance when called, yet because they refused to live peaceably, and not to rise against the king or any authorized by him, they were remanded to prison. However, he was liberated and went to Holland, where after the death of the famous and faithful Mr. Brown, he was admitted minister of the Scots congregation at Rotterdam. And how he says in a footnote, Patrick Walker in his remarks says that while he was in prison he dealt earnestly with Messrs. Kidd and King, then under sentence of death, to give a healing testimony in favors of the indulged, and that he was liberated upon the terms of the indemnity and so forth. However, be as it will, to derogate from nothing due to the memory of Mr. Fleming, it is well known that though he was never actively indulged himself, yet he ran into some extremes in coalescence with them, which was no small grief at that time to faithful Mr. McWard, as witness his earnest contendings and so forth. And that book, Earnest Contendings, is available from Stillwaters. And here again his activity in the ministry was such as was to be expected from such a large soul, comprehensive of the interest of God and of his church. What a writer he was need not here be told, but in preaching he might be called a Boanerges and a Barnabas also for converse, and for all things useful. What might Cambuslang testify of him? What might Edinburgh and adjacent places, where after his ejection he lived and labored? What might Rotterdam say, where, from the year 1679 till towards his end, he was a most bright and shining light? There was no time wherein we may suppose that he had no good design going on. It is well known that the sun of his life did set on an excellent design, which was of sending forth a treatise concerning the ways of the Holy Ghost's working upon the souls of men and so forth. As he was religious, so he was said to be of a peaceable and friendly disposition, as not affecting controversy much, so that when speaking of the differences amongst some brethren, he would say, I am amazed to see good men thus tear one another in the dark, nor can I understand how they should have grace in a lively exercise, who value their own particular designs above the interest of the Catholic Church, and so on. Nor is it to be forgot what he said to one of his own begotten sons in the faith. I bless God, said he, that in 15 years' time I have never given any man's credit a thrust behind his back, but when I had ground to speak well of any man, I did so with faithfulness, and when I wanted a subject that way, I kept silence. And according to his practice, his life was a life of worship extraordinary. His solemn dedication of himself to his God was frequent, his soliloquies with him almost perpetual, as spending his days and years after this manner, in order to which we find it was his custom from the 15th or 16th year of his age, to set apart the first day of every year for renewing his covenant with God, or if interrupted that day, to take the next day following. For the first years of his life we cannot give any particular account of the manner of his doing this, but we may guess what they have been from the few instances following. 1691. In the entry of this new year, as I have now done for many years most solemnly, I desire again to renew my personal engaging of myself to the Lord my God, and for him, and with my whole heart and desire to enter myself into his service, and take on his blessed yoke, and humbly to lay claim, take, and embrace him, O him, to be my God, my all, my light and my salvation, my shield and exceeding great reward. Whom have I in heaven but thee, O Lord, or in the earth whom I desire besides thee? And now under thy blessed hand my soul desires, and does here testify my trusting myself and securing my whole interest, my credit, my conduct, my comfort, my assistance, and my poor children, and to leave myself herein on thy gracious hand, on my dearest Lord, whilst in time, as I write this the second day of January, 1691. Robert Fleming. 1692. In the entry and first day of this new year, that I desire as formerly to enter, in this hidden record, a new surrender and offering of myself to my dear Lord and Master, who hath been wonderfully tender and gracious to me, and hath brought me by his immediate conduct through the days and years of my pilgrimage past, hath still cared for his poor servant, and given more singular mercies and evidences of respect than to many else. And now, as still formerly, hath taken me through this last year with singular evidences of his presence and assistance, and as I trusted myself to my Lord, so he hath graciously answered, for which and his special grace hitherto I desire to insert this witness of my soul's blessing the Lord my God. And now I do here with my full and joyful consent testify my giving up myself again to the Lord and to his work and service here, and wherever he shall call me, with desire to consecrate my old age to my God and the guide of my youth. I love my Master and his services, and let my ears be nailed to the posts of his door, as one who would not go free from that blessed yoke and service, and lay in hope the whole assistance hereof on his grace and help, and so on. To him I commit myself, my ways, my works, and services, which, with my whole desire, I offer to my Lord, in whose hand I desire to secure my credit for the gospel's sake, my comfort and my enlargement in this day of deep trouble and anguish, together with my poor children and the whole interest of my family and concerns, desiring to put myself with humble confidence and all that is dear to me under his care and conduct. O my soul, bless thou the Lord. This I write the 1st of January, 1692, my Lord and my God. Robert Fleming. 1694. In the first day and Monday of this new year, 1694, that as I have formerly through most of my life past, so now I desire to renew my dedication and engagement to the Lord my God, and to join in the same witness with what herein hath been formerly with my whole heart and desire, and to offer to my dearest Lord praise, in remembrance of what he hath been through the year past, and in the whole of my life, whose gracious, tender conduct hath been so wonderfully, and well hast thou, Lord, dealt with thy servant according to thy word, and in all that hath befallen me, and so on. And now I do again, by a surrender, witness my entire commitment of myself, my poor children, my credit for the gospel, my conduct and comfort in so extraordinary a juncture to my dearest Lord, to his gracious and compassionate care and providence, together with my works and my small design to serve him and my generation. And I do entreat new supplies of his grace and strength to secure and make his poor servant, if it were his blessed will, yet more abundantly forthcoming to him. And with hopes of acceptance I write this January 1st, 1694. Robert Fleming. But now, drawing near his end in the same year, 1694, upon the 17th of July he took sickness, and on the 25th died. On his first arrest, O friends, said he to such as were about him, sickness and death are serious things. But till the spark of his fever was risen to a flame, he was not aware that that sickness was to be unto death. For he told a relation that if it should be so, it was strange, seeing the Lord did not hide from him the things that he did with him and his. Yet before his expiration, he was apprehensive of its approach. Calling to him a friend, he asked what freedom he found in prayer for him. Seems God to beckon to your petitions, or does he bring you up and leave dark impressions on your mind? This way, said he, I have often known the mind of the Lord. His friend telling him he was under darkness in the case, he replied, I know your mind, trouble not yourself for me. I think I may say I have been long above the fear of death. All the while his groans and struggling argued him to be under no small pain, but his answers to inquiring friends certified that the distress did not enter his soul. Always he would say, I am very well, or I was never better, or I feel no sickness. This would he say, while he seemed to be sensible of everything besides pain. But the malignant distemper wasting his natural spirits, he could speak but little, but what he spoke was all of it like himself. Having felt himself indisposed for his wonted meditation, that is, his habitual meditation and prayer, he thus said to some near him, "I have not been able in a manner to form one serious thought since I was sick, or to apply myself unto God. He has applied himself unto me, and one of his manifestations was such as I could have borne no more." Opening his eyes after a long sleep, one of his sons asked how he did. He answered, "Never better." "Do you know me?" said his son. Unto which, with a sweet smile, he answered, "Yes, yes, dear son, I know you." This was about 2 hours before he died. About an hour afterwards, he cried earnestly, "Help, help, for the Lord's sake," and then breathed weaker and weaker until he gave up the ghost, and after he had seen the salvation of God, he departed in peace in the 64th year of his age. Thus lived and died Mr. Fleming after he had served his day and generation. His works yet declare what for a man he was, for besides the forenamed treatise, the confirming work of religion, his epistolary discourse, and his well-known book, The Fulfilling of the Scriptures, he left a writing behind him under this title, a short index of some of the great appearances of the Lord in the dispensations of his providence to his poor servant, and so on. And although the obscurity of these hints leaves us in the dark, yet as they serve to show forth his master's particular care over his servant, who was most industrious in observing the Lord's special providences over others, and perhaps may give some further light into the different transactions of his life, they are here inserted. And Howie begins a long quote. "How near I was brought to death in my infancy, given over and esteemed a burden to my friends, so as my death was made desirable to them, I being the refuse of my father's children, yet even I was then God's choice, and in a most singular way restored. 2. That remarkable deliverance in receiving a blow by a club when a child, which was so near my eye as endangered both my sight and life. 3. The strange and extraordinary impression I had of an audible voice in the church at night, when being a child I had got up to the pulpit, calling me to make haste, and so forth. 4. That I, of all my father's sons, should be spared when the other three were so promising, and should thus come to be the only male heir surviving of such a stock. 5. That solemn and memorable day of communion at Greyfriars in the entry of the year 1648, where I had so extraordinary a sense of the Lord's presence, yea, whence I can date the first sealing evidence of my conversion, now 40 years past. 6. The Lord's gracious and signal preservation and deliverance given me at Dunbar Fight. 7. These solemn times and near approaches of the Lord to my soul, the first at Elve when I went there, and the other a little after my father's death in the high study. 8. The scripture Acts 12 was given me to be my first text, and how I was unexpectedly and by surprise engaged therein. 9. The great deliverances at sea going to Dundee, the first time in company with the Duke of Lauderdale, the other in company with Mr. Gray of Glasgow. 10. That extraordinary dream and marvelous vision I had twice repeated, with the inexpressible joy after the same. 11. These memorable impressions and passages about my health, when it seemed hopeless at my first entry upon the ministry, and the strange expression of Mr. Simpson of New Mills. 12. The Lord's immediate and wonderful appearance for me in my first entry to the ministry, with that extraordinary storm on the day of my ordination, and the amazing assault which followed the same in what befell, wherein Satan's immediate appearance against me was so visible. 13. The great and conspicuous seal given to my ministry from the Lord in the conversion of several persons with that marvelous power which then accompanied the word on the hearts of the people. 14. That signal appearance of the Lord and his marvelous condescendence in my marriage lot and in the whole conduct of the same. 15. My deliverance from so imminent hazard of my life in my fall from my horse at Kilmarnock. 16. The Lord's marvelous assistance at the two communions of Cathart and Dunlop, with the great enlargement I had at the last of these two places, at the last table. 17. That as my entry to my charge was with such a bright sunshine, so no less did the Lord appear at my parting from that place, and so on. 18. The Lord's special providence as to my outward lot after my removal thence, in many circumstances that way. 19. the gracious sparing my wife so long when her life was in such hazard in the years 1665 and 1672. 20. The preservation I had in going over to Fife in the year 1672 and the settlement I got there. 21. The dream at Bussay, wherein I got such express warning as to my wife's removal, with the Lord's marvelous appearance and presence the Thursday after at St. Johnston's. 22. That extraordinary warning I got again of my dear wife's death, and of the manner of it at London, in the year 1674. 23. These two remarkable scripture places given me at West Nisbet in my return from London, 1674, that is, that in Romans 4 in the forenoon, and that in Psalm 115 in the afternoon. 24. Those great and signal confirmations given me at my wife's death, and that great extraordinary voice so distinct and clear which I heard a few nights after her death. 25. These special confirmations given me at my leaving my country at West Nisbet, Ridsdale, Stanton, and the first at sea from the Shields. 26. These solemn passages to confirm my faith from Hebrews 11 and Exodus 33, and at other times in London, and the last night there before I went away. 27. These extraordinary and signal times I had at my first entering at Rotterdam. 28. These two marvelous providences that did occur to me at Warden, and about the business of William Mader. 29. The marvelous sign given me of the state of my family, in what happened as to the sudden withering of the tree, and its extraordinary reviving again at my first entry to my house at Rotterdam. 30. The great deliverance from fire in the High Street. 31. The good providence in returning my diary after it had been long lost. 32. The special providence in preserving my son from perishing in water. 33. The surprising relief when cited by the Council of Scotland to appear with that sweet resignation to the Lord which I then had under such a pungent trial. 34. The remarkable event of a warning I was forced to give that some present should be taken away by death before the next Lord's Day. 35. The Lord's immediate supporting under a long series of wonders, I may truly say, for which I am obliged in a singular way to set up my Ebenezer, that hitherto hath the Lord helped. 36. The remarkable appearance of the Lord with me, which I omitted in its place, in the strange providence relating to Mr. Moneypenny's death in Preston Pans. 37. The solemn providence and wonder in my life, my fall under the York coach in August 1654, when the great wheel went over my leg, so as I could feel it passing me without hurting, far less breaking my leg, as if it had been thus carried over in a just poise to let me see how Providence watched over me, and so on. 38. The comfort God gave me in my children, and those extraordinary confirmations I got from God upon the death of those sweet children whom God removed from me to Himself. Close quote. Now, reader, go and do thou likewise, for blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Matthew 24. The Life of Mr. Alexander Shields. Mr. Alexander Shields, son to James Shields of Howhead in the Merse, born year 1660 or 1661, and being sent to school when capable of instruction, made such proficiency there that in a short time he entered upon the study of philosophy under Sir William Paterson, then regent of the College of Edinburgh, afterwards clerk to the Bloody Council, where he made no less progress. For, being of a lively genius and penetrating wit, he soon commenced Master of Arts, and that with no small applause. And having furnished his mind with no small degree of the ancillary knowledge of learning, he began to think upon the study of divinity in view for the ministry. But finding little encouragement this way for any who could not in conscience join with prelacy, or the prevailing defections of those called the indulged, he took a resolution and went over, among others, to Holland, shortly before or after Bothell, for the further improvement of his studies, where he continued some short time and then returned home to his native country. But upon his going to London to be an amanuensis to Dr. Owen, or some of the English divines who were writing books for the press, he had a letter of commendation to one Mr. Blackie, a Scots minister, who, appointing him to speak with him at a certain season, had several ministers convened unknown to him, and did press and enjoin him to take license, so that being carried into it in that sudden and surprising way, he did accept of it from the Scots dissenting ministers at London, but without any imposition or sinful restriction. However, the oath of allegiance becoming in a little time the trial of that place, Mr. Shields studied as he had occasion to show the sinfulness thereof, which these ministers took so ill that they threatened to stop his mouth, but he refused to submit himself thereunto. But it was not long here that he could have liberty to exercise his office, for upon the 11th day of January, 1685, he was, with some others, apprehended by the city marshal at a private meeting in Gutter Lane, who came upon them at an unawares, and commanded them to surrender in the king's name. Mr. Shields, being first in his way, replied, "What king do you mean? By whose authority do you disturb the peaceable ordinances of Jesus Christ? Sir, you dishonor your king in making him an enemy to the worship of God." At which the marshal said he had other business to do than to stand prating with him. Mr. Shields made an attempt to escape, but was not able, and he and his companions were brought before the Lord Mayor, who threatened to send him to Bridewell. However, bail was offered and admitted for him to answer at Guildhall upon the 14th, upon which day he attended with a firm resolution to answer. But while he went out for a refreshment, he was called for, and none answering, his bail bond was forfeited, which afterward gave him no small uneasiness when his bail's wife said to him, "Alas, why have you ruined our family?" However, to prevent further damage, he appeared on the 20th, when he was arraigned in common form and examined, whether he was at Bothell, and if he approved of Bishop Sharp's death, with several other questions, to which he replied that he was not obliged to give an account of his thoughts, and that he came there to answer to his indictment, and not to such questions as these. Upon which he was taken to Newgate by a single officer without any mittimus or any express order unto what prison he should be committed. "By the way," says he could have escaped, had he not been led or betrayed there by flattery. It was some days before his mittimus came, by which he was ordered to be kept in custody till the next quarter session, which was to be at Guildhall on the 23rd of February following. And the mittimus, by the way, is a warrant of commitment to prison. But Charles II, in this interval dying, he was, with other seven who were apprehended with him, March 5th, put on board the Kitchen Yacht for Scotland, and landed at Leith on the 13th. And the next day Mr. Shields was examined before the council, where he pled the liberty of his thoughts, putting them to prove his accusation, and waiving a direct answer anent owning the king's authority, which gave way to his slip afterwards, as he, in his own impartial account of his sufferings, observes among other reflections. Quote, "In this I cannot but adore the wisdom of the Lord's conduct, but with blushing at the folly of mine. I was indeed determined, I think, by a sovereign hand, and led upon this not usually trodden path by truth's confessors, beyond my ordinary genius or inclination, to fence with these long weapons, declining direct answers, which is the most difficult road, and most liable to snares, and wherein it is more hard to avoid wronging truth than in the plain and open-hearted way." Close quote. However, he was remanded back to prison till the 23rd, when he was brought before the justiciary and interrogate whether he would abjure the apologetical declaration and own the authority of James VII. But being still on the reserve, he was sent back till the 25th, and from thence continued till the day following, which he calls the day of his fatal fall, the just desert of his former blind and bold approaches to the brink of these precipices over which he had looked, and was now left to fall therein. Here he was again examined, to the effect aforesaid, and withal threatened with the most severe usage if he did not satisfy them. Whereupon he gave in a minute in writing, wherein, after a short preamble, he says, "The result of my thoughts is in the sincerity of an unfeigned conscience and in the fear of God, that I do renounce and disown that and all other declarations, insofar as that they declare war against the king expressly, proposedly, or designedly, and assert that it is lawful to kill all employed by His Majesty or any, because so employed in church, state, army, or country." When they read this, they said it was satisfactory, and required him to hold up his hand. This he still refused, till allowed to dictate to the clerk what words he should swear. which being done he protested that it might not be constructed to any other sense than the genuine words he delivered in the minute he did subscribe and swear. That which induced him to this, he says, was, they gave it in by his own meaning, and so far was his mind deceived that by a quibble and nice distinction they thought that the word might bear, that this was not a disowning of that nor no declaration that ever he saw, save one of their pretending, nor that neither but in so far, or if so be, which different expressions he was taught to confound by scholastic notions infused into him by the court, and some of the indulged ministers while in prison, and so on. Having so done, the justiciary dismissed him, but on pretense he was the council's prisoner, he was sent back to his now more weary prison than ever. For he had no sooner made this foolish and unfaithful step of compliance, as he himself expresses it, than his conscience smote him, and continuing so to do, he aggravated his fall in such a sort as he wanted words to express. Yet after all this his dangers were not over, for having wrote a letter to John Balfour to be by him transmitted to some friends in Holland, declaring his grief and sorrow, and his mind anent his former compliances and so forth, it fell into the enemy's hands, whereupon he was again brought before the Lords of Council, and though much threatening ensued, yet he owned the letter and declared his sorrow for what he had formerly done. After which they appointed him to confer with the Archbishop of St. Andrews and the Bishops of Glasgow and Dunkeld. With them he had a long reasoning, and among other things they objected that all powers were ordained of God, be they what they will. And I should interject here that this is a common misunderstanding of Romans 13, where it speaks of powers being ordained of God, and an argument that is commonly urged against the biblical view of civil magistracy. But of course, if all powers that are merely ordained in God's decree are therefore lawful, then we would have to own the devil as a lawful authority as well, for his usurped power is also ordained in God's decree. What the apostle is actually teaching in that passage is that the word ordinance means according to God's revealed will, not according to his secret will, that is, according to his commanded institution. And this can clearly be seen because he doesn't describe just any old magistrate. He describes the magistrate as being lawful, to whom we must submit for conscience sake as to the ordinance of God, that magistrate who carries out the instituted requirements of the office, that is, to punish evildoers and be a terror to them who do evil, and a praise and a support to those who do good, which clearly tyrants do not do. And it is truly remarkable that those who call themselves Reformed, especially Reformed and Presbyterian pastors, so-called, would espouse the view that the bishops are espousing here against Mr. Shields, when in fact the Westminster Confession of Faith clearly teaches to the contrary. And yet this is the very confession that these men have supposedly vowed to uphold and teach. But when we look at the original, that is, the only Westminster Confession of Faith, for the confession that is taught and held in these churches is actually the American Confession of 1789, which is a perversion and bastardization of the original, never minding Chapter 23 on the duties of the civil magistrate, Chapter 20 on Christian liberty makes the following distinction between lawful and unlawful power and lawful and unlawful exercise, which distinctions are meaningless if the view that the bishops hold is true. It says in section 4, they who, upon pretense of Christian liberty, shall oppose any lawful power, clearly implying that there are unlawful powers, or the lawful exercise of it, clearly implying that even lawful power, as to its institution or ordinance, can exercise their power unlawfully, whether it be civil or ecclesiastical, resist the ordinance of God. Thus there are lawful and unlawful civil and ecclesiastical powers as such, and amongst lawful, civil, and ecclesiastical power there is the lawful and unlawful exercise of it. And for some excellent works on this topic, I would refer you to James M. Wilson's exposition of Romans 13, 1 through 7, and also the Act, Declaration, and Testimony by the Reformed Presbytery. There's a work by John Fairley called An Humble Attempt in Defense of Reformation Principles, particularly on the head of the civil magistrate, and then a sequel and companion volume to that by John Thorburn called Vindiciae Magistratus. These works are all sold by Stillwater's Revival Books, and I strongly encourage you to obtain them and read them carefully. Finally, I'd like to instance a couple of quotes from our Reformed forefathers, Samuel Rutherford and John Knox, of course, two men that we've already heard the lives of in this book, Scott's Worthies. First, Samuel Rutherford from Lex Rex. Quote, "Providence hath laid bounds on the king's power and made it fatherly and not masterly, so that if it, the power, exceed the bounds of fatherly power and pass over to the despotical and masterly power, it may be resisted by the people." And then he goes on to say, "A power contrary to justice, to peace and the good of the people, that looketh to no law as a rule, and so is unreasonable and forbidden by the law of God and the civil law, cannot be lawful power, and cannot constitute a lawful judge. But an absolute and unlimited power is such. How can the judge be the minister of God for good to the people, Romans 13:4, if he have such a power as a king given him of God to destroy and waste the people?" And then again from that same work, "I lay down this maxim of divinity. Tyranny, being a work of Satan, is not from God, because sin, either habitual or actual, is not from God. The power that is must be of God. The magistrate, as magistrate, is good in nature of office and the intrinsic end of his office, Romans 13:4, for he is a minister of God for thy good. And therefore a power ethical, politic, or moral to oppress is not from God, and is not a power, but a licentious deviation of a power, and is no more of God, but from sinful nature and the old serpent, than a license to sin." And he goes on, "That power which is contrary to law, and is evil and tyrannical, can tie none to subjection, but is a mere tyrannical power and unlawful. And if it tie not to subjection, it may lawfully be resisted. But the power of the king, abused to the destruction of laws, religion, and subjects, is a power contrary to law, evil, and tyrannical, and tieth no man to subjection. Wickedness, by no imaginable reason, can oblige any man." Close quote. And I think we see clearly why Rutherford's work was burned by tyrants like Charles II. And then Mr. Knox, in his conference with the Queen, Queen Mary, said, quote, "If princes exceed their bounds, they may be resisted even by power, for there is no greater honor and obedience to be paid to princes than God hath commanded to be given to father and mother. If children join together against their father, stricken with a frenzy, and seeking to slay his own children, apprehend him, take his sword or other weapons from him, bind his hands, and put him in prison till his frenzy overpass, do they any wrong? Or will God be offended with them for hindering their father from committing horrible murder? Even so, madam, if princes will murder the children of God, their subjects, their blind zeal is but a mad frenzy. To take the sword from them, to bind them, and to cast them into prison till they be brought to a sober mind, is not disobedience, but just obedience, because it agreeth with the word of God." I appreciate you bearing with this impromptu digression. It's just that this misunderstanding is so widespread and has such huge implications for the peace, unity, and well-being of Christ's church that I felt constrained to say something on it. According to the scriptures, the church is to be the pillar and support of the truth. She is to be the witnessing church, and what she's to witness for is the truth of God's word and the purity of his ordinances. And what she's to witness against is any encroachment upon or usurpation of Christ's royal prerogative in the church or in the state. And not only is this clearly taught in the scripture, but we can even see it in the etymology of the word Protestant, protest, pro, to put forth, test, a testimony, or a witness. And so this distinction between lawful and unlawful authority clearly meets us on many different levels in our daily Christian walk, and it's obviously affected and does affect the church at large, as seen in this book, for example. And ultimately, it's nothing less than an issue of sinful men tearing the crown off the beloved head of him who is the head of his church and also the governor of the nations of the earth. But to return to Mr. Shields' answers, he replied to the bishop's false doctrine there, "All power is ordained of God by his provident will, but every power assumed by man is not so by his approbative and preceptive will. One of the prelates said that even his provident will is not to be resisted. He answered that the holy product of it cannot and may not, but the instrument he made use of sometimes might be resisted. It was urged that Nero was then regnant when this command of non-resistance was given. He answered that the command was given in general for our instruction how to carry in our duty under lawful magistrates, abstracting from Nero. Then they asked him how he would reconcile his principles with that article in the Confession of Faith, that difference in religion, and so forth. And the article they're referring there to there is chapter 23, section 4, where it says, "Infidelity or difference in religion doth not make void the magistrate's just and legal authority, nor free the people from their due obedience to him." And that was one that was urged again and again against the Covenanters, though it's easily refuted. He answered, "Very easily, for though the difference in religion did not make void his power, yet it might stop his admission to that power, where that religion he differed from was established by law," and so forth. And in the confession here, they're dealing with an abstracted point of doctrine, not considering the particular situation in Scotland or England. So in a land where you had no gospel light, just because the magistrate is a heathen, if he's generally keeping the institution of God's ordinance to be a terror to those who do evil, according to the light of nature that God has given and the just laws of the land, then just because he's an infidel or of a false religion doesn't make void his lawful authority. But as an instance of what Mr. Shields was talking about, the laws of the land and so forth, we look at the National Covenant of 1638, where it says, "And therefore, for the preservation of the said true religion, laws, and liberties of this kingdom, it is statute by the 8th Act, Parliament 1, repeated in the 99th Act, Parliament 7, ratified in the 23rd Act, Parliament 11, and 114th Act, Parliament 12 of King James VI, and 4th Act, Parliament 1 of King Charles I, and so we see that what the bishops are urging here is contrary not only to the scriptures and the confession, but to the laws of the very land in which they lived. Quote, from this act, these acts rather, that all kings and princes at their coronation and reception of their princely authority shall make their faithful promise by their solemn oath in the presence of the eternal God, that enduring the whole time of their lives they shall serve the same eternal God to the uttermost of their power, according as he hath required in his most holy word contained in the Old and New Testament, and according to the same word shall maintain the true religion of Jesus Christ, the preaching of his holy word, the due and right ministration of the sacraments now received and preached within this realm, according to the confession of faith immediately preceding, and shall abolish and gainstand all false religion contrary to the same, and shall rule the people committed to their charge according to the will and command of God revealed in his foresaid word, and according to the laudable laws and constitutions received in this realm, nowise repugnant to the said will of the eternal God." And then turning to the Solemn League and Covenant, Head 3, "We shall, with the same sincerity, reality, and constancy in our several avocations, endeavor with our estates and lives mutually to preserve the rights and privileges of the parliaments and the liberties of the kingdoms, and to preserve and defend the King's Majesty's person and authority in the preservation and defense of the true religion and liberties of the kingdoms, that the world may bear witness with our consciences of our loyalty, and that we have no thoughts or intentions to diminish His Majesty's just power and greatness." Now we need to remember that every member of the Westminster Assembly was bound by this Solemn League and Covenant, and that the fruition of that assembly is set forth in this covenant, where it says, "And shall endeavor to bring the churches of God in the three kingdoms to the nearest conjunction and uniformity in religion, confession of faith, form of church government, directory for worship and catechizing, that we and our posterity after us may as brethren live in faith and love," and so forth. Now this means that the Westminster Confession then is not teaching anything contrary to the Solemn League and Covenant, and the Solemn League and Covenant is not teaching anything contrary to the detailed and explicit coronation oath that I read from the National Covenant, which all the Scottish commissioners to the Assembly were bound by because they were Scotsmen. And therefore we see very clearly what the Westminster Confession's view of civil magistracy was, contrary to the opinions that are held so widely today and those that were held by the persecutors of the Covenanters. But again, I appreciate your bearing with this digression, but this issue is so important and it's so easy to see what their actual views were with just a few minutes of discussion that again, I felt constrained to add this to these tapes. But returning to the text, He was continued till August 6th, when he was again before the justiciary and indicted, which made him write two letters, one to the advocate and the other to his old regent Sir William Paterson, which he thought somewhat mitigated their fury. Whereupon he drew up a declaration of his sentiments and gave in to the Lords of Council, upon which much reasoning betwixt him and them ensued. After two conferences wherein he was asked many questions, in the third he condescended to sign the oath of abjuration, which they had so much insisted he should again take, as he had at their command torn his name from the first. Only it was worded thus, "If so be such things are there inserted," which he told them he was sure was not the case. This was with difficulty granted. As he subscribed, he protested before them that none were to think by this he justified the act of succession or the abrogation of the ancient laws about it, or the want of security for religion or liberty, or that he acknowledged the divine approbation of it, and so forth. When all was over, he was delayed till tomorrow. But tomorrow he was sent to the Bass, and doubtless would have suffered, had he not got out in woman's clothes and eloped. After his escape, without seeking after any other party whatsoever, he came straight to Mr. Rennick, and that faithful contending remnant then in the fields, where upon the 5th of December, 1686, he attended a meeting for preaching at the wood of Earlston in Galloway, after which he continued with Mr. Rennick for some time, in which time he ceased not, both in public and private, to give full proof and evidence of his hearty grief and sorrow for his former apostasy and compliances. Upon the 22nd he came to their general meeting, where he gave them full satisfaction in espousing all and every part of their testimony, and likewise made a public confession of his own guilt, wherein he acknowledged, 1. That he had involved himself in the guilt of owning the so-called authority of James the Seventh, showing the sinfulness thereof, taking shame to himself. 2. He acknowledged his guilt in taking the oath of abjuration, and his relapsing into the same iniquity, the sinfulness of which he held forth at great length, and spake so largely to these particulars as discovering the heinousness of that sin, as made Mr. Rennick say, "I think none could have done it unless they had known the terrors of the Lord," and added, "I thought it both singular and promising to see a clergyman come forth with such a confession of his own defections, when so few of that set are seen in our age to be honored with the like." After this, when Mr. Rennick and the United Societies were necessitated to publish their informatory vindication, again which is published by Stillwaters as well, Mr. Shields went over to Holland to have the same printed about the beginning of the year 1687, but it appears he was necessitated to return home before that work was finished. After Mr. Rennick's death, he continued for some time in the fields preaching in Crawford Muirs, at Dissent Cornhill, in Galston Parish, and many other places, and about the end of the same year, 1688, when Kirsten and the United Societies, who had, in the interregnum of the government, thrust out some of the curates and demolished some of the popish monuments of idolatry, were obliged to publish a vindication of themselves in these proceedings, which they did at the Cross of Douglas. Mr. Shields, being present, did sing some verses in the beginning of the 76th Psalm, "In Judah's Land God is Well Known," and so forth, making some notes, and while expatiating on the same, said that this psalm was sweetly sung by famous Mr. Robert Bruce at the Cross of Edinburgh at the break of the Spanish Armada the same time 100 years ago. Upon the 3rd of March, 1689, when Mr. Linning, he, and Mr. Boyd renewed the covenants at Borland Hill in Lismahago, Mr. Shields stood up again before a vast confluence of people and declared his unfeigned sorrow for his former sin of compliances and so forth, to the affecting of all the multitude and the abundant satisfaction of the godly there present who had been grieved therewith. At and after the Revolution he was of much service to the army, and greatly esteemed by King William, and after his return home he, with the foresaid Messrs. Linning and Boyd, presented a large paper of proposals to the First General Assembly after the Revolution, both craving a redress of their grievances, and likewise showing on what terms they and their people could and would join with them, and so forth. And I'll be reading that paper, it's quite a long one, at the end of the account of Mr. Shields. But this paper, being judged by the committee of this assembly to contain, quote, "peremptory and gross mistakes, unseasonable and impracticable proposals, and uncharitable and injurious reflections, tending rather to kindle contentions than compose divisions," it never once got a hearing, but was thrown over the bar of that assembly. And yet, notwithstanding all this, the three foresaid brethren, being resolved to unite with them at any rate, gave in another called the Shorter Paper, importing their submission, casting down all their former proposals and desires at the assembly's feet, to be disposed of, quote, to be disposed of as their wisdom should think fit, close quote, which paper he, through their insinuation, was brought to subscribe, and of which it is said, he sadly repented afterwards. And how he says in the footnote, Patrick Walker says that Mr. Shields much lamented his silence before the assembly, and of his coming so far short of his former resolutions, and if ever he saw such an occasion, he would not be so slack. Messrs. Linning and Boyd had too much influence upon him, being in haste for stipends and wives. Returning to the text, for having dropped his former testimony at their feet, who trampled on it, and though they did not rent him, yet they soon found out a way to get rid of him. For, soon after the revolution, he was settled minister at St. Andrews, where he continued in the discharge of his office until the year 1699, that he, with Messrs. Borland, Stobo, and Dalgleish, were pitched upon to go over with his countrymen to the national settlement at Darien in America, where he, by letters under his own hand, gave particular account of matters there, wherein it is evident that his spirit was quite sunk with the divisions, impiety, and unrighteousness of too many of that handful, and at last was sadly crushed with the fatal disappointment of that undertaking by the conduct of the then government, which he showed, had it been faithfully and well managed, might have been of great advantage to this nation as well as to the Christian religion, and yet for want of a proper reinforcement they were either cut off or dissipated. While in Caledonia, he preached mostly on Acts 17:26-27, God hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of our habitation. One time, as he and the rest of the ministers made a tour up the country, upon their return they were bewildered in the woods, and hearing the noise of the sea, they got at last to the shore, and so were obliged to pass through various windings and bendings of the coast under lash of the swelling surges or waves of the sea, being sometimes obliged to climb upon their hands and feet upon the steep and hard rocks, until at last Mr. Shields was like to faint, which troubled them much. Their provision and cordials were spent. At length they came to a welcome spring of fresh water springing out of the rock by the seaside. This, says Mr. Borland, was to us as that well was to Hagar in the wilderness. By this well we rested a little, and Mr. Shields, having drunk of it, was refreshed and strengthened, and with the help of the Lord we were enabled to proceed in our journey. After which Mr. Shields and Mr. Borland escaped death very narrowly, the ship sinking in the harbor of Kingston a very little after they were gone out of it. He died of a malignant fever June 14, 1700, in a Scotswoman's house at Port Royal in Jamaica, a little after he left Caledonia. A kind countrywoman, Isabel Murray, paid the expense of his funeral. His last preaching was from the last words of Hosea, "Who is wise, and he shall understand these things? Prudent, and he shall know them, for the ways of the Lord are right, and the just shall walk in them, but transgressors shall fall therein." And thus the so much famed Mr. Alexander Shields, after he had tasted somewhat of the various vicissitudes of life and fortune, was obliged to die in a strange land. He was a man of a low stature, ruddy complexion, quick and piercing wit, full of zeal whatever way he intended, of a public spirit, and firm in the cause he espoused, pretty well seen in most branches of learning, in arguing very ready, only somewhat fiery, but in writing on controversy he exceeded most men in that age. His works are The Hind Let Loose, Mr. Renwick's Life, and The Vindication of His Dying Testimony, his own impartial relation, The Renovation of the Covenant at Borland Hill. There are also some lectures and sermons of his in print, A Vindication of Our Solemn Covenants, and several of his religious letters both before and since the Revolution, and a number of these things that I've just mentioned are available from Stillwater's. After his death, Mr. Linnings published an essay of his on church communion, but how far this agrees with his conduct at the Revolution, or what coherency it hath with his other writings, or if Mr. Linning had any hand therein, is not my province to determine at present. There are also three pocket volumes of his journals yet in manuscript, which were, among other valuable papers, redeemed from destruction after Mr. Linning's death. And now I'll read the large paper of proposals to the First General Assembly after the Revolution that Shields, along with Messrs. Linning and Boyd, presented. To the moderator and remnant members of the General Assembly, now convened at Edinburgh, October 1690, the humble proposals of Mr. Alexander Shields, and so forth. If our eye could suitably affect our hearts this day, right reverend, we might find much matter both of rejoicing and mourning in the wonderful commencement and advancement of this work of reformation. We are called to rejoice with thanksgiving for the mercy of God manifested and magnified in the progress of this work hitherto, that the Lord hath been pleased in sovereign mercy to prevent and surprise us with such a reviving in our bondage by the repression of tyranny, suppression of popery, and depression of prelacy. When the doctrine of this church is asserted, and the confession of faith formerly received is read, voted, and approved and established by Parliament, the worship and ordinances of Christ are administered in great purity, plenty, and peace. The government of Christ's institution, that is, church government, is at length restored to what it was in the year 1592, and the discipline retrieved to such a fond of freedom that all ecclesiastic courts may, without restraint, or being accountable to any exotic usurped power in the magistrate, assert all the authority and exercise the power wherewith Christ hath instituted them. Now all of these were part of the establishment of the so-called Revolution Church of 1689. Which power, if duly and diligently improved and put in execution, may, through the blessing of God, contribute very much to the reducing of order and the redress of many disorders in this church. And now, the causes of our disunion and division in times of defection, being in a great measure removed, when Erastian usurpations are abrogated, the church's intrinsic power redintegrated, and the corruptions introduced by compliances so far abdicated and antiquated that they are not in the constitution of the church and do not continue to be the scandal and snare of the times, we hope and expect a remedy may be found for our breaches and divisions that we thought incurable, and union and communion in the Lord may be attained. We are no less obliged to mourn when we observe this house of the Lord so unlike the former, wanting many things the former had, and pestered with many things the former wanted. They that have seen our former reformation in its integrity, before the late deformation, can hardly refrain from weeping at the sight of the sad disproportion between this and the former. In the former, as the Constitution was calculated in the nearest conformity to the divine pattern, so the builders had always a care to pull down what was to be demolished before they established what was to stand, and to purge away the rubbish from the foundation before they promoved the superstructure. Accordingly, when prelacy was reintroduced at several times, the first thing they did when they recovered their power was always to exert it in condemnation of that corruption and of these assemblies and meetings that promoved, abetted, favored, or complied. And when the Erastian supremacy began to encroach upon the church's liberties and to bring the ministry into bondage, they did not think it enough to wrestle against it by personal witnessings, but by the good hand of God upon their endeavors, never ceased until it was condemned by acts of assembly. They proceeded also with great earnestness and vigilance to purge the church of corrupt and scandalous ministers. But now, after all the rubbish and filth brought into the house of God by invasions and usurpations of the enemies and defections of friends, when now opportunity and capacity is given to rebuild and beautify the house of the Lord, and to repair the desolations thereof, the present building is so far advanced without pulling down and purging away the rubbish and condemning these corruptions and defections in compliance with them, or confessing and forsaking them as our fathers used to do. And the prelatical clergy, after all the evil they have done and bitter fruits they have produced, are yet kept in many places and like to continue as a seminary and nursery of a corrupt ministry. As long as this rubbish stands, there can be little hope either of purity or stability in the superstructure. In former reformations also, the advancement used to be progressive, beginning where the former reformation stopped, and going forward after they had got removed what obstructed. But now, the motion is retrograde, going as far back as that in 1592, missing many excellent steps of reformation attained after that in 1649. That is, up to 1649, from 1638 to 1649. In former reformations, our worthy ancestors used to begin with renovation of the national covenants and acknowledgment of the breaches thereof, which hitherto hath been neglected, to the great grief of many. It is also a matter of lamentation to reflect that in former reformations, though adversaries troubled the builders and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose, yet being furnished and spirited of the Lord for that generation work, they never studied to please men, but to acquit themselves as faithful servants of their princely master, Jesus Christ, in witnessing against all sins and corruptions of great and small impartially, and in acts of assembly, ordaining and recommending to all ministers this faithfulness in applying their doctrine to the sins of the time, under pain of censure. But now, though there was never greater freedom and encouragement for, and necessity of faithfulness, when the adversaries of Judah are seeking to build, but on design to mar the work, and many are too much inclining to join in affinity with the people of these abominations, yet it is sadly wanting and much desiderated among many ministers, that is, the application of the doctrine to the sins of the times, who, being long accustomed to fears and constrained silence, have not yet recovered their confidence and courage to cry aloud against and not to spare the iniquities of the time. Though in former reformations this church was, for order and authority, beautiful as Tirzah, comely as Jerusalem, and terrible as an army with banners, yet now, alas, the crown hath fallen from our heads. Woe unto us that we have sinned. This holy and beautiful fabric hath been burnt up with the fire of enemies' furies, with the fire of our divisions, and with the fire of the Lord's indignation, burning against us for our defections, whereby the Lord was provoked to forsake his house, and since his departure there hath been nothing but disorder among his children and servants. The popish, prelatic, and malignant party have come in by force and fraud, and by the seedings of those that should have stood in the gap, have broke down the carved work of our covenanted reformation, rescinding all the legal bulwarks of ecclesiastical constitutions, civil sanctions, and national covenants wherewith it was fenced. Wherein, alas, they were too much encouraged by our faint resistance and too universal involvement in the sin of submitting to and countenancing of the intrusions of the prelatical party. At length, having set up these their ensigns for signs, in sign of complete victory obtained over the servants and subjects of our exalted prince, after they had invaded his kingdom and place, and made havoc and slaughter of such as would not yield, they offered some tempting terms, whereupon they would suffer them to live in subjection to these usurpations, painted indeed with pretenses of favors, but really, at least indirectly, requiring a recognizance of the usurper's power and a cessation from opposing the peaceable possession of their robberies. These and the like defections on the one hand, together with many extravagancies on the other, have brought the godly into many confusions. We did indeed demur to concur with and follow, and did think it our duty to withdraw from these ministers who promoted courses of defection after specified, and to adhere to those, though but few, who were more steadfast and faithful. When the case was so stated that we thought communion could not be kept by us with them, from whom we withdrew without sin, while the very exercise of their ministry was so far depending upon, subordinate unto, complying with, modified and authorized by unlawful usurpations, that our joining would have inferred, at least in our conscience, a submission to, symbolizing with, and approving of their offensive yieldings to these encroachments. Yet we never thought this a schism. Therefore, that this happy and desirable union may be holy and comfortable, in a way that may procure and secure our union and communion with the Lord, and considering in all the periods of this church, from the first Reformation, a witness hath never been wanting against the same or equivalent corruptions that have offended us, and no method can be more adapted for recovering and restoring union than that which was used for preserving it, and that having aimed hitherto to offer and keep up our might of a testimony against the same, if now under the convictions of its remaining righteousness we shall pass from it, and so seem to condemn what we approved before, and approve what we condemned before, it will leave an indelible reproach not only on ourselves, but on our contendings and sufferings. This concludes tape 17 of John Howie's Biographia Scoticana, or The Scots Worthies, the 1781 edition. This work is available from Stillwater's Revival Books, along with a treasure trove of the finest Protestant, Reformed, and Puritan literature available anywhere in the world today. Stillwater's may be reached at area code 780-450-3730 or by email at swrb@swrb.com. Stillwater's website is www.swrb.com and contains numerous free books and articles. Again, please note that these tapes are not copyrighted, and we therefore encourage you to copy and distribute them to any and all you believe would be benefited.